Okay, so Tehillim Perek Aleph, the first chapter of the book. What are some questions that we have from skimming the Mizmor?
How does the man know he's happy that he's not walked in the council of the sinners or whatever, the seat of the scornful? He's never done it. He doesn't appreciate how much better this is.
Interesting. Right? You're saying the poet knows that there are the wicked and the righteous, and they know that being righteous is better than not. But maybe the person who's never tried it doesn't know. Or how does he know that he's in the right path or not? Yeah. Interesting question.
It's
nice to learn with other people for that reason. Yeah. The one observation I'll make is a lot of the commentaries take those verbs in the first pasuk. Lo halach batzar rasha'im. They're past tense verbs, like literally speaking. Most of the commentaries take them to be present tense. They don't mean they've never walked in the path of the wicked. It means that they don't. That's not their way. That's not their habit to do so. So they're past with a connotation of sort of continuous activity. The other thing that you could say is, I think there are certain kinds of bad behavior that you might know that you're not meant to do even without trying. Right? It's not that every one of us has, tried hard drugs before deciding that we don't want to take hard drugs. We know that's not good for us. We hear the stories and we hear our teachers and we take insight from the Torah and whatever way we learn about what's right and wrong, it's not all experimentation. Every question for me about this Mizmor is kind of clouded by the fact that it's the first one in the book. So every layer of meaning feels like it's amplified 150 times in terms of setting the tone for everything that Sefer Tehillim is teaching us.
That's true.
So questions like that have important relevance. Right, so of course, what is this Perek doing as the first one of Tehillim? Just to sharpen the question a little bit, if I asked you, before this year or even in the course of the year, right, what is the genre of the book of Tehillim? So maybe that's a thesis statement of Tehillim. This is what Tehillim's teaching us. But what kind of book is it? Or what is included in the book, generally? We've seen, 30 to 40 prakim. There's some Musar. We haven't seen a ton of those prakim ourselves, but that's because those prakim tend not to get into davening. The ones that play into davening, which has been the selection bias that we've used in this series, have more to do with praise.
Yeah.
Right, a lot of that, Hallel in its various forms,
right.
Thanksgiving,
bakasha,
and supplication and requests.
Mm-hmm.
Requests.
Question.
Levakesh, yeah. So I think I haven't done the statistical mapping of what every parak falls into, and every parak can clearly be categorized. But I think you would argue that by default, you would expect the major themes of Tehillim to have to do with praise or prayer or thanksgiving. And that's actually not really present here. This is a parak of Musar.
Yeah.
Right? It's telling you about the righteous and the wicked. And it's not even really prayerful. We don't really talk to Hashem in this parak at all. Right? We're talking about the righteous and about the wicked and about their fate. And we're not, I think at any point, maybe I missed something in my reading, communicating to Hashem about how he should relate to the tzaddikim and the rishayim. We're describing what Hashem already does. So I think that makes this a bit of an atypical parak to begin with, and one that's not quite representative of the book. The book is called Tehillim, Tehillah, praise, and less to do with these elements of Musar. So what is this doing as the beginning of our parak? That's going to be one question we will tackle today. One thing I did anticipate in advance to be able to think about. Any other thoughts or observations? Okay, so it could be setting a tone. Maybe there's something about setting a tone of we are tzaddikim, or we know that we should be tzaddikim.
We'll listen to our prayers because we are tzaddikim.
Okay, right, it's partially a justification. So we'll unpack some of those details. I think that's going to be broadly a fruitful line of thinking. Right, the book, if it's not talking about Hashem, if it's talking about us, well, what kind of us do we want to be before engaging in the prayerful process of Tehillim? So that might be a useful avenue. And I think once we appreciate what the Mizmor is really telling us about the righteous and the wicked, then we'll better, I think, be able to see that holds up, that idea really you know, characterizes the background to being able to study Tehillim, which is why we really should have done it first. But next time we do a series on Tehillim, we will be sure to start here. Okay. We'll save it a few years at least. All right. Okay, so the plan for our shiur, and I know I left us with another question, which is what is that metaphor of the tree in the middle of the perek, and we'll touch on that when we get there. But what we'll do, I think, is do three stages. We'll first talk about just the background to be aware of when you think about the first mizmor. Is the first mizmor really the first mizmor, or maybe does it go with the second perek, which we won't be studying today? So it's just to flag it as a relevant issue when you're studying Tehillim to know this. Then we'll do our read through of the mizmor and unpack, you know, line by line what it's doing structurally and what it's telling us about the Rishayim and the Tzaddikim. And we'll conclude by circling back to our main question, which is what does this mizmor have to do for us in characterizing or framing the Book of Tehillim as a whole?
And did David write this parak?
And did David write this parak? Which, of course, you know, we can circle back to our very first class together and touch on whether David wrote every parak in Tehillim, whether he wrote some of the parak in Tehillim, and certainly that's going to be you know, an important question to ask when you learn any parak.
He did write it, and he wrote and started it out as a book for somebody else to know, and then became a conversation with Hashem throughout this. So I always feel like when I'm reading it that there's a message there for the reader, and obviously that's what he's probably trying to do. But I feel like sometimes it changes the genre, changes from here's an overview to here, I'm not so sure about this, let me speak with Hashem about it and he'll tell you what he says.
Right. Well, just to like zone in on that point, right? So the first two Prakim of Tehillim, we'll only do Parak Aleph today. Parak Bet is often seen as related to Parak Aleph in ways that I'll briefly allude to. Parak Gimel begins with a mizmor David said on the run from Avshalom. Mm-hmm. And we immediately, at the very beginning, you know, right after these two perhaps introductory chapters, we then get to the beginning of David's biography, and David as this personal speaker in the book is then flagged, which in turn I think makes these two prakim seem much more universal, meaning they're not spoken from David's perspective, there's no reference to David's history, there's no reference to David surrounded by enemies or David talking to Hashem. So this parak in particular I think has a very universal kind of valence. Whereas some other prakim, you have either explicit references to events in David's life, or you get the sense that they're in the context of David's relationship to the Beit HaMikdash or David's relationship to his enemies, and you see certain personal elements kind of fitting in.
These weren't put together by David, though, right? He just did writings, and somebody else put it together, right? Is what I remember reading. Is that true or not?
So this brings us back to our very first class, where we talked about the authorship of the
right.
book. One, you know, version, I think probably the more standardized mainstream version in Jewish tradition says that David really anthologized a lot of older songs and also added his own. And
so
that
maybe this wasn't the first thing he ever wrote.
Correct, correct. So the question of chronology is very important, right? Is the book organized chronologically in David's life? It could be, but not all the mizmorim are really going to line up well if you try that, if you just track all the historical data. For example, you have elements, you know, this is the Perek Gimel is David in Avshalom's, in running from Avshalom, and then later on you have Prakim about David communicating with like Doeg, who's one of Shaul's servants, so that jumps you back in Sefer Shmuel and the timeline. So chronology is not really going to work. There probably is some kind of structure to the Book of Tehillim. I think we talked about that the first time also, at least a little bit of the overall structure. And there are certain trends you see. Like, for example, more prakim in the beginning of Tehillim have LeDavid or Mizmor LeDavid or LeDavid Mizmor at the beginning than ones at the end of Tehillim. So there are certain trends like that. But that would be, you know, to circle back to the intro shiur, that could be important in understanding the book as a whole. Whether this is the first thing David ever said or anyone ever said might not be relevant because someone organized a book and put this mizmor first. So whoever organized it, David or anyone else who was involved, certainly, you know, means something by that,
yeah,
if they're organized.
It's a good first page, right?
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, great. So let's get started. So just to the question of the Perek Aleph versus Perek Bet and why I chose to do it this way. So the Gemara, Masechet Brachot, in source number 2, tells us that the first two chapters of Tehillim are actually one parsha, right? And that Also, you know, a lot of this circles back to our intro, Shir. I think appropriately, you talk about the first parak of the book. It reminds you of all the introductory material. You know, we think there are 150 prakim in Sefer Tehillim, but not every traditional source says so. So there are midrashim that say there are 147 prakim in Tehillim, like the 147 years of Yaakov's life. Well, if that's true, obviously some of our chapters are joined together or broken apart. And we talked in some sessions about whether, let's say, I think Kuf Yud Chet, for example, we said some broke it up into almost five different chapters. So the organization is not so clear. And the Gemara here says the first two really are one. Ashrei Ha'ish, which is our parak, and Lama Ragshu Agoyim, which is parak bet, are Chada Parshahi. They're a single parsha. And then a few lines later, Kol Parsha Shaita Chaviva Al David. Any parsha, any poem that David composed that he... I guess was particularly beloved to him. I would like to think most of them were beloved, but any ones that particularly stuck out. Patach Baba Ashrei, he started with the word Ashrei. V'siyem Baba Ashrei, and ended with the word Ashrei. And in this case, we have that exactly. In the beginning of our Mizmor, we have Ashrei Ha'ish. Patach Ba Ashrei Dechtiv Ashrei Ha'ish. V'siyem Ba Ashrei Dechtiv Ashrei Kol Chosevo, which is the end of Perek Bet of Tehillim. And we could point out a couple of parallels in source number 3 between the language in our parak and the language in the beginning and end of parak bet. So the phrase, Lama Ragshu Goyim Ulomim Yehegu Rik, that phrase Yehege, which means to think or probably more likely to say or to speak. We have that here, Ubtorato Yehege Yomam Balayla. Similarly, at the end of that parak, we have a Vitovdu Derech, the ways of these wicked nations. You know, will be lost. V'derech Rishaim Toved at the end of our parak is the same language. And of course, the Ashrei as well, Ashrei at the beginning and Ashrei at the end. So there are good literary reasons, you know, linguistic reasons to think these parakim are connected. You have similar language between parak Aleph and parak Bet, as well as, you know, a framing device of Ashrei at the beginning and end, and Chazal certainly attests to that fact as well. I felt nonetheless, you know, compelled to break them up. You know, firstly, because Aleph and Bet would be a lot to do in 1 week, and that would take a great deal of time, and we want to be sensitive to the time that it takes to do a parak well. Mm-hmm. Second of all, our Masorah has, at the end of the day, chosen that they should be separate prakim. So it's true that, you know, you might think of them as belonging to the same parsha, but the way that our traditional Tanakh has organized that, we've chosen to split them up. And the Radak in source number 4, which we won't read together, makes that comment as well. It says all of the accurate books of Tanakh actually split up these two. So even in the Middle Ages, there's at least some attestation that there's attention about this question, but that the Radak and others fall on the side of seeing it as an individual standalone parak. And the final reason to do so, I think, is because we could see Perek Aleph and Perek Bet as very related, but they're not exactly the same Perek. We're not studying Perek Bet now, but broadly speaking, it's fair to say that Perek Aleph is speaking about the individual righteous and the individual wicked, and at Perek Bet, the Perek begins, Lama Ragshu Goyim Ulumim Yeheguri. We're talking about nations, we're talking about peoples, and almost everything that we say in Perek Aleph about the righteous and the wicked individuals is then sort of scaled up to the broader communal scale. Or societal, national scale. So it is fair, I think, to look at each one individually, and then if you wanted to, you know, bring them together and see how they compare, that would be a valuable exercise as well. But I thought proper to just focus on our first parak as a standalone unit and just focus on the individual element. It also fits the title of this series. I have not played up the title very much in these classes, but I've called this Portrait of a Religious Persona, which should be focusing on individual personas and religious people. This is the top left corner. That's been the title of the series and the program from the Kolos perspective. So we'll choose to focus on the individual for that. Okay, so moving past that and the framing to the actual Mizmor itself. So let's read in our usual manner from the beginning of the parak. Ashrei ha'ish. Fortunate is the person, happy is the person. Ashrei has different connotations. And the connotations certainly go together, meaning if you are morally fortunate, then you are also likely to be subjectively happy, is the part of the claim of our Mizmor. So that ambiguity about the meaning of Ashrei, I think, certainly works quite well. But who is Ashrei? Who is fortunate in this way? It is the person, Asher. There's maybe a little wordplay there. Ashrei the person, Asher does the following. What you do, how you behave, how you are, will affect whether you are ni'ushar, whether you are Ashrei. And in this case, it refers to how you relate to the wicked in the world. Asher lo halach ba'atzat rasha'im, who did not walk in the counsels or along the advice of the wicked. Uvederach chata'im, and in the way of sinners lo amad, you do not stand in the way of sinners. Uvmoshav leitzim, and in the seat of maybe scoffers. Leitzim doesn't mean clowns in the modern Hebrew sense, like leitzanim. It is a more negative connotation. Leitzim are cynics, or leitzim are
hecklers.
They're people who are really attacking. They're not just saying nonsense. Lo yashav, you do not sit with them. And you have these three verbs, and there's a debate in the commentaries about the progression of these verbs. Meaning, what's the most severe thing that you can do? Is it walking in the ways of the wicked, or is it sitting in the presence of the wicked? That would be my intuition as well. All right, so Rashi and Chazal along those lines seem to say that sitting would be... Sorry.
You chose your place.
I'm sorry, that sitting would be the worst, right, along those lines, right? You don't walk in their ways, because if you walk in their ways, then you might come to stand and consort with them and spend more time with them. And if you, you know, stand with them and talk with them, you're more likely to sit and be established with them. And if you're sitting and hanging out with them, and now you're sitting around in the afternoon and you're, you know, with all of these Rishayim, that will have a corrosive kind of influence on you. Other commentaries, like Rav Moshe ibn Jikatila in source number 6, go in the opposite way. I don't walk in the ways of the wicked. That means to behave like them, to be like them. Well, not only do I not walk in their ways, I don't even stand. I don't even, you know, encounter them. You know, I don't even stand at the crossroads and think about which way I want to go. I'm not even going to do that. I'm not even going to sit with them. I'm not even going to have any kind of engagement with them. You know, forget the fact that I'm not going and doing wrong things, but I'm not even going to spend time talking to the wrong people. I'm not even going to spend time sitting with these different councils that they, in chatting with them, before I do anything with them. Just even sitting and thinking with them is something I'm trying to avoid. Regardless of which interpretation you take, you definitely see a progression in this mizmor, and I think a certain kind of building, especially according to Rashi. You know, you don't go to the Atzar Rishayim, they don't even spend any time with them, and try to dissociate yourselves as much as possible in these ways. Now that's all the sur meira, that's all the things you don't do. You don't consort with them, you don't spend any time with them, you don't walk in their ways. And Robert Alter points out, maybe Ashrei also is a little bit of a pun. This is where you need a good linguist in your toolkit. In source number 7, Robert Alter quotes Nachum Sarna, a contemporary scholar, who raises the possibility that the first word of the Mizmor, Ashrei, is a pun on the word Ashurim, which means steps. So, also, it talks about my paths and my ways, and I'm holeich in this, and I am in the derech of that. And Ashrei, I'm not even going to walk in their way. Even Ashrei alludes to that idea about whose paths you follow and whose steps you walk in. Okay, continuing. That's all the Sur Meira, but let's get to the Asei Tov. So what do? You don't just refrain from things. Surely just refraining from sinning is not considered good enough to be, the fortunate person. You also have to do something. And this thing is the Torah. Ki'im b'torat Hashem cheftzo. The Torah of Hashem is his desire. It's what he wants and cares for. Uv Torato, and in his Torah, Yehgeh Yomam Balayla. He speaks. Some understand it can be internal, like meditation. I think more likely it means he speaks in it day and night. Okay, so there are a few interesting differences between the Tzaddik and the Rasha reflected here. And then the first interesting difference that's reflected is that there's actually something specifically constructive being mentioned. Meaning the Rishayim, it doesn't say what they do, what they care about, what they're trying for. They just do things. Whatever it is they do, we don't want a part of it. But I have a goal. I'm positively pursuing the Torah. Something specific that I'm aiming towards and pointing towards. And not just, orienting myself along the lines of what people happen to be doing, but it's some kind of positive goal. Another difference, it seems to me, which I think relates, is that there aren't active verbs in this pasuk. In our first pasuk, we're talking about behaviors. You stand, you sit, you walk. It's kind of reminiscent of Kriyat Shema. B'shiftecha b'veitecha uvlechtecha v'derach. When you sit and when you walk, how you travel your ways. But here, your relationship to the Torah is primarily emotional or internal. The Torah is my desire. It's what I feel. The Torah is something I think about or I speak about. Those are not, you know, strong actions in the way that walking or standing or sitting even could be considered actions. So the verbs are much more characteristic of an internal life as opposed to an external life. And I think that suggests those two details, as they fit together, suggest to me a contrast between the righteous and the wicked, where the righteous are primarily inner-driven people who might not even need to be oriented around other people. It doesn't say, I avoid the Derech Rishaim and I pursue the Derech Tzadikim. I avoid the Derech Rishaim and I do my own thing, which is inner-driven, which is driven by my own pursuit of truth, my own pursuit of the Torah, and not driven by what everyone else is interested in doing. So it's solitary, but it's also being an iconoclast and countercultural, being Avraham, who's on the one end of the world, Avraham Ivri, he's on one side, everyone else is on the other side. Because you could be solitary and still be a righteous person. You don't need to be with the other tzaddikim in order for that to work. And that's where I think the first couplet of the Mizmor goes. You know, the first contrast between the righteous and the wicked is what they do, the wicked, or rather, you know, the pursuit of the ways of the wicked versus the pursuit of the ways of the righteous. Psukim Gimel and Dalet shift gears. It's another couplet, another pair of psukim that go together. And this pair of psukim gives us a metaphor or a figure of speech that we might use to think about this a little bit more. So we have the metaphor of the Eid Shatul. The Haya, this righteous person, this fortunate person, is like an Eid Shatul al Palge Mayim. He is like a tree that is Shatul, which is, let's say, planted for now, though we'll unpack that in a moment, on the streams of water. And this tree is going to be very fortunate. Asher Piryo Yitain Bi'ito, its fruits will be given in its time. Va'alehu Lo Yibol, and its leaves won't shrivel or wither. The whole asher ya'aseh yasliach, everything it does, it will succeed in. Okay, so what does this metaphor tell us about the righteous person? What do we learn about him from comparing him to this tree that is planted?
He's secure, solid. And
there's something solid about it, right? A tree is firmly rooted.
Right.
You got to use a nice pun when you translate it into English. It's rooted in the ground. It's really firmly located. And it's not, moving around or... unstable.
And it's continuously being nourished. It's supported.
Right. So it's firmly rooted in the ground, and it's connected to the water. It's being nourished. What's the water here?
Torah.
Presumably the Torah. In mayim ela Torah, Chazal say. The water represents the Torah. And the Torah, which he pursues and thinks about in the first pasuk, and he thinks about day and night, by the way. He thinks about it when he's out in the world. He thinks about it even in his own personal life. And he engages with it in that way. And that nourishes him, and that causes his growth and his success. The Torah is the source of all of that. Any other features of the metaphor that are interesting?
I read once that in Tehillim, that water, when water is used in Tehillim, it represents Jewish people. So here's a man, he's the tree, he's going to join the Jewish group, and he's going to learn, and he's going to become more strong and more fruitful and plant other... help other people get
this. That's really interesting. I'll take that one other direction. We talked about the being planted. What about the perot or the leaves? What does that have to do with the tree?
It's a fruit from it. What
are the fruits of the ish, the good ish here? What are his fruits?
His children,
right? You could take it in the kind of more literal way. He'll have children, and they'll probably walk in his ways and so on. What else could it be? Maybe he contributes to Torah itself. That's another possibility. Could also be good deeds. Chol asher yaseh yatzliach. Everything he does is successful. So whatever work you do in the world, whatever your pursuit of goodness is, you're going to be successful at that. Radak adds one other element. We'll turn to it in a moment, but we have to see the contrast to the Rishayim for a second. So all of this is true for the Tzaddik. What about the Rasha? Lo chen ha-Rishayim. The Rishayim are not this way. Ki'im kamot, they are like the chaff. So the husk of a grain of wheat, of a kernel of wheat. Asher tidfenu ruach, that is blown away by the wind. Which I think gets to that permanence idea, right? The question of whether you're stable, like a tree that's firmly rooted in the ground. And shatul could actually mean it's really firmly and deeply entrenched. Depends how you understand the word shatul, but that has that kind of could have that connotation of being very deeply grounded in the earth. unlike the moat, which is blown away by the wind, right? The wind doesn't blow down the tree, but the wind blows about all of the moats. And moats, this chaff, you know, bran, it's basically useless, right? You took all the wheat, you took the grain, that's what's nourishing, that's what I want to keep. And this, I'm happy to be blown away. It's kind of purposeless. That's another element of the contrast. But there's a third element of the contrast, which Radak picks up on. So we'll look at source number 10, we'll read the Radak. The Radak says, Ki ha'adam ha'tov, the good person, yichu mimenu b'nei adam piryo ubusaro. They will take his guidance, his peirot, or the guidance he gives to other people. V'hu she'yilmedu mimenu torato. They'll learn his Torah. He draws from the Torah in the form of water. He produces Torah in the form of fruits that he gives to other people. Uma asaf ha'tovim, and his good deeds that he does. V'alehu lo yibol. His trees will not, his leaves will not wither. What's the point of leaves on a tree? They're good for a tree, because they nourish a tree. Why do I care that a tree has leaves? Because I get the shade. In other words, he causes good for everyone who's around him as well. They are sheltered under the tree's leaves. That's why it's important that they not wither. Right? You have a few examples in Tanakh. Right? Avraham has an eshel, which maybe is a tree that he lets people, visitors, stay under. Yonah has his kikayon. It's also a tree that protects people. The idea of tzel being a protective force is certainly well attested. But the wicked are not that way, says the Radak. He says, Utsuatam larahu kemo hamot. Their work is evil, like the chaff, like the bran of the wheat. Vuakash hadak. It's the light straw, shebeteven, and the wheat. Shelo yehenu imenu b'nei adam. That offers no benefit to people. It's useless. Varuach tidfenu kal meheran. It's blown very quickly. Viazik b'tsumato. If you were walking in a farm and wind was blowing chaff in your face, that would be very unpleasant. So unlike the tree, which has a protective quality and protects the people that it's with, the wicked are a cause of danger for people. They bump into you, kind of irregardless of where you are, and they could cause harm to you. Chaff gets in your eyes. It hits their face, it hits their eyes. It generally won't be pleasant. Or or it'll interrupt your agriculture. It'll get in your house and make a mess. It'll get in the field and interrupt the other crops that grow. And certainly that would be a problem as well. So in the metaphor now kind of expands exactly this contrast between the righteous and the wicked. So the righteous are like an eitz shatul, as opposed to motes, you know, which is like a collective noun. There's a lot of motes. There's a lot of little, you know, bits of chaff, but each one is useless, and together they're harmful, like the Rishaim that get together to do bad. In the meantime, the eitz, the righteous person, is standalone and is able to help many people who come into his orbit. He provides fruits, he provides shades, he's only a positive, constructive force. I think there's a bit of a pun here, or at least a certain kind of play on words, in the idea of the Eitz Shatul as opposed to the Atzat Rishaim in Pasuk Aleph. And again, a little bit later in Pasuk Aleph. Whether the word Atzah and Eitz are etymologically related, there's certainly a play on words there. You're not in the Atzat Rishaim, which is a plural collective group of Rishaim who are all doing bad. You are a singular Eitz, and you are behaving in contrast to them. So the contrast, I think, is heightened in particular by this linguistic pun. I think one more way to double down on this contrast, or on this theme of the Rishaim being kind of unstable, you know, floating around like chaff on the wind, is through comments of Ibn Ezra and Radak in sources 11 and 12. We'll look at Radak because he justifies this point a little bit more. He's getting at the etymology of the word Rasha. So we usually think Rasha means wicked. You know, it's a moral claim. You are a wicked person. You are evil. The Radak says etymologically, there's a different connotation. The connotation of almost being unsettled, right? Like the chaff in the wind and unlike the tree that is settled. The Rasha'im, Hema Charedim, they are anxious, right? The translation here, feverishly anxious. Liknot mamon, to get wealth. The ta'avat libam, and their physical desires, b'olam hazeh, in this world. V'lo yivchenu ben tov l'ra, and they won't care about good and bad, and they'll just, they'll steal, and they'll kill, in order to get what they want. And then the second line, ki inyan harasha, hu acharada. The idea of rasha is not evil wickedness, but it's being restless. It's being unsettled. And he quotes a few psukim, which we're not going to get into the context in Eov right now, where it sounds like there's a contrast between being settled, being shokate in the Lashon and Iyo Paraklama Dalid, as opposed to being Yarshia. Right? So there's the calm and the peace that the Tzaddik has, as opposed to the unsettledness of the Rasha, which maybe is another part of that contrast or comparison between these two. The idea that the stability of the tree, the stability of its roots, and the good it does for people is being contrasted to the unsettled, restless, unsatisfied nature of the Rasha. And you get the sense also that the righteous person is one who maybe is satisfied with their work, satisfied with their lot, as opposed to a Rasha who, if you're in the pursuit of physical pleasure, will constantly be on the search for more and better and never be properly satisfied with a meaningful life. So that's our second couplet, our second stage in the Mizmor. We start with the description of the contrast literally of the righteous and the wicked, and then the metaphorical contrast that plays up certain elements of those two. Now finally, we get to maybe the conclusion of the Mizmor, which has to do with their fate, the consequences. Al Kain begins the section. Therefore, here's what will happen. Because the righteous are stable and rooted and constructive for themselves and for others, and the wicked are unsettled and messy and they're swayed much more by what other people think than by the stability and the, you know, singular confidence that the tzaddik has. Therefore, here's what's going to happen. Lo yakumu risha'im ba'mishpat. The wicked will not stand in judgment, meaning they won't be vindicated. They won't be able to stand up to judgment. Before, they were standing, right? There's the atzad risha'im, their holech, their omeid, their yoshev. Here, they will no longer stand. They will be, you know, defeated in judgment. The chata'im and the wicked and the sinners will not be, the word lo is carried on from the first part of the pasuk to the second, the sinners will not stand in the adat tzadikim. Just like the tzadik did not stand in the derech chata'im, well now the chata'im in judgment will not stand in the adat tzadikim. That's also not going to happen. And here we have tzadikim finally for the first time as like a collective noun. There's a group of tzadikim. Because tzaddikim don't require a group in terms of how they live their lives. Eventually, they'll be judged, and many people will be judged individually righteously, but each person can be righteous on their own, whereas the wicked are wicked together, so to speak. I think that contrast is being highlighted by introducing tzaddikim at this point. And finally, ki yodea Hashem derach tzaddikim. Hashem knows the ways of the righteous, v'derach rasha'im toved, and the way of the wicked will perish. So, a couple of interesting things about this this pasuk. First of all, we have derech again. We have the derech rishayim from before. Now we have the derech tzadikim, which is what is actually going to last, and that's actually what one should pursue. The contrast, of course, between the derech rishayim, which Hashem knows, and the derech rishayim, which will be destroyed, is obviously important. And the derech rishayim, interestingly, seems to be destroyed on its own. It's not that Hashem destroys it. Necessarily, is that the Derech Rishayim will, kind of be defeated. Hashem knows our path, and Hashem ignores the path of the Rishayim, and it'll kind of lead to its own destruction, right? Chaff doesn't thrive well on its own being blown around. But Hashem takes care of us, and is Yodea us. And the phrase Yodea, Hashem knows the path of the righteous. Philosophically, you could ask Akasha, you could say, Hashem knows everything. What do you mean Hashem doesn't know the path of the wicked? He only knows the path of the righteous. So one approach, I think, is to say, Yodea here has the connotation of a certain kind of intimacy and relationship, right? Adam et Chava Ishto. Adam knows Chava, there's an intimacy, obviously connoted by that term Yodea. There are plenty of places where Yodea has the sense, not of cognitive knowledge, but of intimate personal knowledge, and a real, personal connection.
Understanding.
And personal understanding, certainly. I think there might be one other way to take this, which requires a bit of a leap of faith on your parts, but you may want to take this journey with me, so we could try that. A lot of the psukim, a lot of the imagery from our Mizmor have a lot of parallels in a section in Sefer Yirmiyahu. In source number 13, Yirmiyahu Perek Yud Zayin. We're not going to deal with the context right now. He's speaking about the righteous and the wicked here. And he draws very similar contrasts between the righteous and the wicked. Koamar Hashem, Arur HaGever Ershev Takba Adam, Vetam Basar Zeru'o, Umin Hashem Yasur Libo. Cursed is the person who trusts in man, makes this man the source of his strength, and removes his heart from Hashem. Well, what's he going to be? Ke'ar'ar Ba'arava. He will be like a certain kind of desert bush in the wilderness. V'lo yireh ki yavo tov, and they won't see good that will happen. V'shachan charirim b'midbar eretz melecha v'lo teishev. They will live in the dry places in the wilderness, eretz melecha, salted land, dry barren place where nothing can grow. By contrast, Baruch HaGever, Asher Yivtach B'Hashem, B'Haya Hashem Yivtacho. We know this pasuk. Fortunate is the person. It's Asher Ha'ish. No, it's Baruch HaGever. But it's a very similar kind of idea. Who trusts in Hashem, makes Hashem his source of trust. And he is like an Eid Shatul Almayim. V'al Yuval Yishalach Shor Hashav. He will embed his roots in the river. The lo yireh ki yavo chom, and they won't be concerned when the sun shines, when the heat comes, right? Unlike the Rishayim, who will not see good, he will not see heat come. Vaya aleyu rahanan, leaves will all be fresh, they will all be verdant. Uvishan patzoret lo yidag, he doesn't have to worry in the time of famine. Velo yamish me'athot peri, will always be able to bear fruits. It's very much the same image here, with a tree grounded on water, with fruits, with leaves, everything is thriving here. So it's interesting, parallel. He's obviously drawing on some of this language. I think chronologically here, it makes sense to argue that Yirmiyahu is borrowing from Tehillim. I mean, Yirmiyahu is, the end of the period of the first Beit HaMikdash, presumably, even if you're willing to say that some of Tehillim is written later, certainly you wouldn't want to say that about the first Perek, obviously, and also something that could have been written earlier. This isn't a Perek that obviously says, that screams out, I'm written in the period of the second Beit HaMikdash, or I'm written very late. There's no Al Naharot Bavel, kind of planting you in exactly that period of time. So it makes sense that Yirmiyahu is borrowing this language from Tehillim, or this metaphor from Tehillim. But he adds a certain element, which I think adds a new valence to this idea of Yodea Hashem, Akov Halev Mikol Va'anush Bi'Yida'enu. The heart is tricky, it is bent, it is corrupt. Who can know it? Mi'Yida'enu, who could know one's heart? Ani Hashem Choker Lev Bochen Klayot. Pasuk Yod. I, Hashem, know what is in one's heart. I judge their kidneys, which was understood in Tanakh as a metaphor for wisdom. Maybe what we would call like gut knowledge in modern English, things that are not usually conscious. And therefore, v'latet le'ish kidrachav kifri mala lalav. And to give each person the fruits of their due, that which is their, that which is their right. So perhaps Yirmiyahu is, borrowing this Mizmor's imagery, using it to give Musar to the people in his days. Maybe the people also know this image from Tehillim, and they'll kind of appreciate the metaphor very clearly of why they're doing wrong. And when it says, Yodei Hashem Derech Tzadikim, Yirmiyahu is adding an idea. Yodei Hashem, meaning Hashem has knowledge of our intentions, knowledge of what we're trying to pursue. And so even if a person maybe stumbles along the path of the righteous, but Hashem knows what's happening internally. He knows our minds, he knows our hearts, he knows our intentions. And that's part of how we're judged. So a person might look like a tzaddik, but really inside they're a rasha. Well, Hashem will be able to judge that. Hashem knows their ways and knows whether they're going to be sincere or not. Knows whether their insides match their outsides, and vice versa. And so in thinking about what makes a tzaddik and what makes a rasha, we already alluded to the idea that a tzaddik has a more vibrant internal locus, an internal guidance by the Torah. And Hashem appreciates that. That being righteous and being wicked has a lot to do with your intentions and your internal life, and not what everyone is doing. It's not mediated by whether you're with this group of people or this group of people. Well, those are Rishayim, and those are Leitzim, and those are Chatayim. I don't need to be defined by a group of people. I just need to be defined by my own sense of good and bad and right and wrong. And Hashem knows whether I'm being driven by an accurate sense of following the Torah, and will reward us accordingly. Which is, I think, if I'm right, and that's a very interesting example of Yirmiyahu being kind of an early interpreter of this parak of Tehillim. Which is interesting when parts of Tanakh kind of interpret each other. We've seen a few examples like that this year. And that concludes the Mizmor, really. So we have a description of the ways of the righteous and the wicked. We have the metaphor that expands on those ideas, the permanence versus impermanence, personal stability versus being swept along by the current of what other people are doing, being helpful as opposed to unhelpful. And the faith that you get, of course, correlates to what you are worthy of. If you're a Rasha, you'll be defeated. If you're a Tzaddik, you will be known by Hashem, have a relationship with him, and certainly in some broad scheme of history, be rewarded. So if that's the thesis of our Mizmor, really drawing this very stark contrast on multiple levels between the righteous and the wicked, so we can circle back to our initial question and say, okay, so what is this Mizmor doing at the beginning of Tehillim? Well, why does it belong here? It could be in the middle of Tehillim. Could be in the book of Mishlei, for that matter. You know, it's telling you wisdom. It's telling you how to live. So tell me that in Mishlei. What does it belong in Tehillim for? So some commentaries address that. Just to pick one example, Radak in source number 14 says, well, David began with this because of the important philosophical ideas. V'kala David bezeham is more, Torah ta'adam, the law of man, u'mashara u'ilu la'asot bezeha olam, what he should do in this world. V'agmula tov letadikim va'onet l'arashayim, the idea of schar va'onesh, that good happens to good people and bad happens to bad people. V'azem is more nechbad ma'od, it's a very important mizmor, let's say, it is honorable, nechbad, and therefore he began his book with it. Well, because the ideas of righteousness and wickedness as categories, and the idea that the righteous thrive and the wicked don't, is an important idea to begin your book with. Yeah, it could be, right? That would be my question, really, which is, well, if that's true, so put it in a book that deals with the philosophical questions of right and wrong. Put it in Mishlei. Put it, you know, maybe it should be part of the Torah. The Torah doesn't have language like this. David obviously can't choose to add things to the Torah, but you might think it belongs there. Maybe it belongs in Kohelet. You're meditating on the nature of goodness and badness and the permanence, question of permanence and impermanence, and meditating on death. So that would be a perfect place for it. What is it doing specifically in Tehillim? And that's where I think you have to get to questions of the genre of Tehillim and what a person saying Tehillim could need to be. So, you know, maybe a second approach would be to say that Tehillim also, it solved my problem. You could say Tehillim also has wisdom in it. Really, I was wrong in characterizing Tehillim as a book of songs and praises, and really it's more of a wisdom-oriented book than that, and the ideas of righteousness and wickedness do appear in several places. We have in the Mizmor, Shir Shal Yom for Shabbat, for example, Tzadik HaTamar Yifrach, the Tzadik will flower like the Tamar, Ke'erez, Balvanon Yisgeh. You have certain prakim and tehillim that really do meditate on the righteous versus the wicked. A lot of the Shir Shal Yoms actually touch on those themes. I think for Tuesday you have the idea of Hashem standing in judgment and the righteous judges versus the wicked judges. So maybe I'm wrong about Tehillim, and it really is a wisdom, you know, book that has more wisdom elements than the ideas of, you know, philosophical ideas in it. But I think we could also say what we really suggested at the beginning. You know, we're beginning the book with a description of righteousness and wickedness, both for individuals in Perek Aleph and in Perek Bet for nations. And that's background that you need to be the kind of person who could create, could recite, could relate to Tehillim in the right ways. First, you establish yourself, or at the very least, your values as being among the tzaddikim as opposed to being among the rishayim. And once you lay that groundwork for yourself, knowing that fundamentally you're going to need to be a little bit countercultural, deviating from the groups of the wicked and being standalone in your righteousness, you'll know you need to be grounded in Torah Hashem, which Chazal say in that pasuk. We didn't mention this for the first time, but Chazal say, Ki mitrat Hashem chatzo uv torato, in his Torah, yege yomam v'layla. So it could mean Hashem's Torah, or it could mean your Torah. Once you really internalize it, it becomes part of your identity, and that's how you think of yourself. It becomes your Torah. So Chazal pick up on that as well. And you establish yourself as a righteous person who knows how to be righteous, to ground yourself in the Torah, to be willing to be countercultural, to be helpful to other people, to grow in your own Torah, to produce peyrot, in the sense of Torah, peyrot in the sense of future generations. And once you get that, and you get the fundamental idea of schar va'onesh, then the rest of Tehillim will work for you. It'll make sense to recite the rest of Tehillim. You'll be able to relate to the rest of Tehillim. You'll develop that personal relationship with Hashem that's manifest in many of the Mizmorim in Tehillim. And you'll be able to ask things from Hashem in the proper way because you've established the baseline relationship that you're meant to have. I am a righteous person. Hashem knows me. Ki yodea Hashem derach tzadikim. He knows me as a relationship with me. And from there, the rest of Tehillim can really soar. All those ideas of the relationship work on the foundation, the moral foundation being established in this parak. So now, you know, we go back to the beginning of the year, we start studying Tehillim, and every idea of Tehillim might be a little bit more palpable or a little bit more actionable or a little bit realer to us because we establish ourselves as people who are guided by the Torah and whose relationship with Hashem is mediated in that way and is understood in that way. It's kind of a shame now to end on this. I feel really bad. I learned a lot this year with all of you, both my own methodology of how to study Tehillim and how to teach Tehillim, and in the lesson that Tehillim has to teach us. I think if I was to do this again, I would definitely start with this Mizmor, because it really sets a groundwork for establishing our foundational commitments, establishing who we are as individuals, our identity as tzaddikim, and then everything that we would learn together would be valuable. But I hope it worked this way as well. So I'm grateful for that opportunity to learn with all of you this year. And looking forward to much more when we get back from break, however it works.